MacCast, Monday, August 18th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it is another day, another round of, well, I guess it's another week or so, really, and another round of Mac news and information and hints and tips and tricks to bring to you. Have a pretty good show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking about, of course, the latest rumors surrounding what Apple is bringing out next. That would include things like updated iPads, of course, the iPhone 6. I'm a little bit actually flustered and disappointed by some of the iPhone 6 rumors, and we'll talk about the reasons why around that in this episode. Also, a potential graphics issue for some of you MacBook Pro owners out there, and you're not getting the satisfaction from Apple that you would quite like. That, along with another couple updates, patches to Safari, and the latest edition of the OS X Yosemite beta. And then we'll follow that up with some follow-up on our target display mode conversation. Also have some tips and tricks on Time Machine maintenance, rather, and also breaking up your iPhoto library, along with how to remove photos from the Messages app. So we've got all that in this episode, but before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Sanebox. If you're like me, and you probably are, you get a lot of email, right? We all get a ton of email, and we're only getting inundated with more and more email. And staying on top of it, staying in control of it, can be almost a full-time job in and of itself, because traditional ways of doing that sort of thing would be to set up rules and filters, and they're complex, and you kind of have to maintain them, and they don't really always work. Well, Sanebox is a service that helps take care of that. It brings sanity back to your inbox. And what it really does is it kind of provides a bunch of tools and things that you can use to make sure that your inbox only has the emails, the most important emails that you want to see in it. And then it takes everything else and kind of puts that off in another area where you can go and look at it later. You don't have to have everything in your inbox. Like every newsletter that you subscribed to, you don't necessarily want that in there. You want that information. You want to be able to go back and review it, but you don't need it right there in your inbox. So it moves all of your unimportant emails out of the inbox, puts them into separate folders, and then it sends you a summary email saying, hey, this is what we did. Put these messages over here. You probably want to check them out. Those messages over there. It is an incredible service, and it has saved me a ton of time. You only have your important emails in your inbox, and then you can process everything else in bulk later. And what's great is it works everywhere on any email provider, any client, any device. You just simply see those folders everywhere that you check your email. And how does it know what's important, what's not important? Well, it actually analyzes your behavior and your past behavior in real time. So it looks at, what emails do you open? How quickly do you open them? What do you respond to? How quickly do you respond to them? And it determines the importance of your incoming emails without you ever having to set up a rule, do anything else. It doesn't look at any of the content, just the headers of the email to figure all this stuff out. And it's amazing the job that it does. I absolutely love it. And that's just the start of things. They keep adding new features and functionality. They have a bunch of other features like one-click unsubscribing. You can snooze emails. So if an email comes in and you want to be reminded, hey, I need to look at that a couple days later, you can set up ways to do that. So it'll come back in a day or in a week or even in custom time frame. Has cool features like putting all of your attachments that you get in your emails directly into your Dropbox so they're not eating up all that space. And the Sanebox team recently released a Kindle book to kind of help out with getting your inbox in order. It's called How to Outsmart Your Inbox, and for 99 cents on the Kindle store, you can check it out. Also, if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, you can actually read it for free. So I wanted to mention that as well, because that's another tool. You can see how they're just dedicated to straightening out email. And good news is that you can get a free trial of Sanebox, and you can also get a $10 credit on your Sanebox order by heading to sanebox.com /MacCast and just trying it out. I think you're really going to like it, so check it out. And a big thank you to Sanebox for their support of the MacCast. Finally, this week we have a rumor that is not the iPhone 6. We're still going to talk about the iPhone 6. It seems like all we've been hearing about lately is the iPhone 6, what it's going to look like, what it's going to do. We will have more of that in a bit. But this week, actually, Bloomberg came through with some details on the next generation iPad Air. They say the next version of the 9.7-inch tablet has gone into production along with the next generation of the iPad Mini, and that the new Air will feature a brand new anti-reflective coating on the screen. That really should help out with viewing outdoors, especially in bright light, probably indoors as well. If you've ever had issues with like overhead lighting, specifically fluorescent lighting seems to be the bane of my existence sometimes when I'm trying to use my iPad. It will hopefully help out with that. I'm wishing and praying that it will actually work better than Apple's oleophobic coating, you know, the thing that's supposed to prevent smudges and oil from the screens. Yeah, that hasn't worked out too well, I don't think. Anybody who's used an iOS device or any touchscreen device, I don't even think this is just an Apple problem. You know that that thing gets all greased up. So hopefully it'll be better than that. I always worry a little bit about coatings on devices because they have a tendency to scratch. Anybody who's had these kinds of coatings on their glasses or any kind of lenses. So hopefully Apple's found a high quality anti-glare, anti-reflective coating to put on that. I think that's something Apple offers on or used to offer on displays at some point on MacBooks, right? I don't know if they still do that anymore. I can't remember. But that hopefully should help out in those kinds of situations. Unfortunately, the report doesn't mention any other new features or improvements, but I think we can assume some things. I think some things are pretty obvious. I think we can expect an updated processor, likely an A8 processor, also upgraded graphics in there. I think there's no doubt that all new devices moving forward that Apple's going to put out are going to have the Touch ID sensor in there. We've heard rumors to that effect that both the iPad Air and the iPod Touch will be getting Touch ID. I think that's a logical upgrade for Apple to do. Also, possibly an improved battery life. We always hope that when Apple brings out new models, we're going to get better and better battery life. Don't know about the screen. I would imagine screens are probably going to stay the same at the Retina and same resolution. I don't think the form factor is going to change too much. Could possibly get a little bit thinner. But beyond that, other things we've kind of heard, maybe Apple will jump up to 802.11 AC Wi-Fi. That I'm kind of indifferent on or feeling like it's not necessary. I don't think Apple needs to do that, and I would worry about battery life and performance. Again, they have to keep the battery life improving on each generation of devices, and a lot of Apple's competitors are getting really good at the battery stuff or better at the battery stuff. Apple can control more in hardware and software, so they can typically do more than less, but I would think that that's where they're heading. And why Apple isn't doing major updates to the iPad this time around, I think it's that the iPad sales and tablet sales in general, they're kind of coming to this stasis point. It's a fairly mature product category, and it's not having that rapid rise in adoption. A lot of people who want tablets have got tablets already, so you're entering this phase of when are people going to be upgrading, and people don't tend to upgrade every cycle, I don't think, with tablets. It's a little bit different than phones, where you have a lot of people who are upgrading their phones every 1 to 2 years. I can see tablets being on more of a desktop, laptop, computer cycle, maybe a little more accelerated. So every 2 to 3 years, 3 to 4 years is maybe when people are going to upgrade. So I don't think you're going to see Apple moving forward making big improvements in the iPad line every couple years. It's probably going to be every 3 to 4 years we're going to see some major changes and differences. And I think that makes sense. The advantage of that is when you bring out new models, it tends to take a hit. Your margins tend to take a hit. So having a mature product, not changing too many things, just doing incremental improvements means Apple's going to be able to keep margins and profits on each generation of iPad higher as the sales sort of flatten out. So that'll kind of offset lower sales, more profits, and kind of keep the iPad running along. And that's good news for Apple's bottom line. So that said, I think this is going to be the year of the iPhone and possibly Apple's wearable, the iWatch. Although we haven't heard too many strong rumors about the iWatch recently coming out in September, which is when we're expecting to see the iPhone 6. So let's move on to the iPhone 6. We're beginning to see a lot of what is being reported as the final or assembled versions of the iPhone 6 in terms of the design. And they're coming from moderate to, I would say, reputable sources, places like Sunny Dixon and Feld and Volk. These places have had a pretty good track record of getting early production or pre-production kinds of products. And recently, Sunny Dixon did seem to get a hold of a pre-production design, reportedly of an iPhone 6 case, and it represents what he thinks we'll likely see in the product when Apple shows it off in September. And the bummer for me is that if it is that, it's the same old fugly versions of what we've been seeing in these mock-up. It has those hideous full surround antenna breaks, the metal end caps. I'm really hoping Apple goes with the iPhone 5S design where we've got the glass end caps, you know, around the camera lens and flash and on the bottom of the phone, and that those antenna breaks aren't so huge. We've seen some designs that look just gorgeous with the glass inserts and smaller antenna breaks, and I'm really hoping the production models end up looking like that, not like these mock-ups we've been seeing. I think they're awful. Also, in the Sunny Dixon leak, there's hints of a wart-like camera bump similar to that of the iPod Touch on the back. So I have no idea what's going on with this design. I kind of feel like if this is the design, Johnny has lost it a little bit for letting this go forward. I don't like to bring this up, so I don't say this lightly, but I have to say if Steve Jobs was still around, I find it really hard to believe in looking at these designs that they would have gone forward. For me, the thin design works when it's sleek and sexy. You don't want a bunch of blemishes and bumps and gaps and things like that in the design. It should be slick and clean and really classy. That is the Apple style, and I'm just not seeing that in these leaked designs. But one area where it does look really nice is Feld and Volk had the front panel, alleged front panel for the iPhone 6, and it has a nice rounded glass edge, a beveled edge on the glass front panel that melds seamlessly into the back casing of the phone. And that's the kind of fit and finish that I would come to expect from Apple. So along these same lines of these kind of leaks that are coming out, that immediately you look at the design and you go, there's no way that can be it. TMZ, of all places, reportedly had a fully assembled iPhone 6. And luckily, when I saw it, I thought fake. A lot of sources reported that this was actually the fully assembled iPhone 6. Fortunately for us, the unofficial Apple weblog also joined in and calling it fake. And they pointed out some of the discrepancies because they showed it fully assembled and running what was supposed to be iOS 8. And immediately when they were looking at the OS on the screenshots, they could tell it looked like some of the Android fake iPhone 6 Android device mockups that we've seen before. Specifically, they called out details like the font in the calendar icon. It was much too bold. Something that they didn't say in their report, but I kind of noticed almost immediately, is the Safari compass icon didn't have the little tick marks on it. So if you're running iOS 8, you can kind of take it out, compare it to the images that were leaked by TMZ, and immediately see this is not the operating system. And then if you just look at their mock-up, the device that they're showing off, to me, it looks like a terrible build quality. There's an indented SIM tray component, kind of goes in a little bit. I don't think Apple would have that. It would be nice and flush. And to me, the silver finish on that device looks like a Krylon, you know, metallic spray paint job. It really doesn't look like brushed aluminum. I think it seems plasticky and fake. So I'm calling bogus on that leak. And we are also starting to get some questionable leaks about or showing off 5.5-inch iPhone 6 parts. Logic boards, one thing that would be very welcome, again, coming from a questionable source, so I don't really know, is that they say they had a 2,915 milliamp hour battery. That is a huge battery, would definitely be a huge battery for Apple. We've seen multiple times a 1,810 milliamp hour battery that's supposedly destined for the 4.7-inch model. So I'm starting to believe that one. I'm thinking that's going to be the battery that we're going to see. It's a modest bump up from what we've seen in the iPhone 5S. For comparison, the Moto X from Motorola, the 4.7-inch model, that has a 2,200 milliamp hour battery. So Apple's 4.7-inch battery would be slightly smaller than some of their competitors. But once again, Apple can really tweak the software and the hardware integration to get the best battery life out of it. So Apple's able to do a lot more with battery life with less actual battery power than a lot of their competitors can over on the Android side. But the 5.5-inch leak is also calling the 5.5-inch model the iPhone 6L. The assumption is that it would be L for large, but what a lame name. So you know, in that leak, when they added that in there, it's like, well, that's just, there's no way Apple's going to, well, again, never say never, right? They did come out with the 5C, and that was a little bit questionable at first. So Apple has had this tendency to kind of tack a letter onto their phone naming, but 6L, really? Why not just call it the 6XL? I don't know. I don't like that name. I'm hoping that's not going to be the case as well. So we might end up with, just in summary, right? We might end up with a ugly looking phone with a camera bump with these ugly antenna breaks, and it's going to be called the iPhone 6L. What do you think? I'm becoming less and less excited about these rumors. And I guess this is just going to be the cold water version of the iPhone 6 rumors, because what about sapphire, right? Sapphire glass, this beautiful material we've been hearing all these great things about. Apple's had this partnership for years, and it's been this will it, won't it have sapphire glass question. It's like the question of the year. And the Wall Street Journal thinks that Apple will now only use the material in two of the models of its higher-end iPhone 6s. And they are saying that's due to cost and the limited availability. This is all stuff we've heard before, right? It's going to be too expensive for Apple to produce. They're just not going to be able to make enough of it. The Wall Street Journal also says that the material, because of the cost, is going to be really expensive for consumers. So even on those high-end models, you're going to be expected to shell out more if you want the sapphire glass version. So it's going to come at a big price premium. Now, that's not something that Apple's ever shied away from. You know, they're not afraid to bring out a new model, especially on the top end, at a higher price point for consumers. So if they need to do that, I could see them doing that. I'm really hoping, though, it's going to be sapphire across the board. I think this is really important. And a JP Morgan analyst, he goes even further. He thinks the sapphire display is not going to materialize on an iPhone at all this year. Again, citing that it costs about 10 times higher than Gorilla Glass. But I think the key here is that a lot of these analysts, they're looking at the cost just in the marketplace in general. And they're not thinking about GT Advanced Technologies and this tight partnership Apple has had with them. As a matter of fact, the JP Morgan piece does mention that GT Advanced Technologies acquired a company known as Twin Creeks, and they have a wafering process for producing sapphire glass called Hyperion that they say could significantly reduce the cost of actually building sapphire glass screens. But the point from the analyst is that it's too early. They've just acquired that company, so it's too early for that process or those technologies to be used in the current production for the current iPhone 6 model. So he's really thinking we're not going to see sapphire on iPhones until next year. But I think it's going to come down to what Apple has been doing in secret over the last couple years with GT Advanced Technologies. And there's one camp that I'm putting my money behind that really thinks they've been stockpiling sapphire glass for Apple for the past couple years, and that they have far more production capacity than most of these analysts think. And they also say that the close partnership has possibly yielded new production techniques and cost-saving measures that the rest of the industry and other folks really aren't privy to, that they don't know about. And I think this is going to be a huge coup. I might have brought this up on the last show. I think this is going to be a big bombshell that Apple drops at the announcement that, hey, we have this new material Tim Cook's talked about, or it might have been Johnny Ive that talked about Apple's focus on new materials this year was going to be a big factor. And I think it's going to be the thing that has all of Apple's competitors once again scrambling to catch up, just like last year when Apple did the 64-bit processor. Nobody saw that coming, the 64-bit A7, and they even tried to immediately slough it off and discount it, but yet now we're starting to see them trying to play catch up and get to 64-bit processors, and Apple's competitors really are just getting there right now. So I think it's going to be the same thing with the glass. Everybody's just been, you know, resting on their laurels, going with the Corning glass and not looking at other materials. And Apple has spent the last few years really developing and honing this technology. And I think they need to get it out this year. With all the Sapphire hype and everything that's been building up around the iPhone 6 and it having a Sapphire display, there's a big emotional investment by a lot of people. And I think if Apple can't deliver, it's going to be a big blow to the company, both just in terms of sentiment around the company or faith in Apple and their ability to actually execute on things, and also could end up being somewhat of a financial defeat, because I think that's going to be the big thing that sets the iPhone 6 apart. Apple's playing catch up on the screen size in a lot of people's minds. And so a lot of consumers are holding off because they want that larger screen phone. But there's also a lot of people that really want the Sapphire glass, completely scratch resistant, super rugged and durable. And I think Apple really needs to try and deliver that this year. That's going to be a key selling point for the iPhone 6 and something that will actually drive sales. Another thing that came out this week that's kind of interesting, I don't know if it's going to do anything for sales, is there's rumors of a new USB to Lightning cable. And you wouldn't tend to get that excited about the cable, but what is being shown off, again, from sources like Sonny Dixon, is a reversible connector on the USB 3 side, the side that goes into your computer. So if you're familiar with current cables, those are what's called a Type A USB cable connector, and it has an orientation to it, right? The connector's on one side of that, and you have to plug it in a certain way. You can't flip it over. This connector basically has that little separator piece right in the middle of the USB connector, and it looks like it's a little bit thinner, and then they have contact points on each side. So it doesn't matter which way you plug it into your computer, it will make the connection. And unfortunately, I think for Apple, if this turns out to be true, there's a company called Ultratech that already sells this kind of cable. I had no idea it existed, but it's branded as a flipper. And Ultratech actually has a patent on the technology that was issued back in 2010. Now, it's unclear if Apple's actually licensing the connector or if they've even talked to the Ultratech company, but it's looking like they probably didn't, because they filed for their own patent on this technology just last month. So remains to be seen, but it looks like Apple is moving forward. They're probably going to do the classic thing that they do, is put the product out on the market, and then when the lawsuit comes up, they will probably turn around and then try and license the technology or do a deal with Ultratech. I'd imagine they could probably buy the patent outright if they really wanted to. But also something that immediately confused me, because the two stories came out almost at the same time, there was this reversible Lightning connect or USB to Lightning cable that Apple was producing, but the USB spec organization came out with a new specification for USB 3.1 on what they're calling a Type-C connector. I guess that's the USB 3 connector. That is actually reversible, a reversible connector that would be on both ends. It actually looks like a micro USB connector almost. It's tiny, and it's completely symmetrical, so almost more like a Lightning cable. And imagine kind of a Lightning cable on both ends, but more in the design of a USB, a micro USB. And that would be able to be flipped back and forth. But if Apple picked up and adopted that, it would require actually putting a new connector on your on your Mac, something that they'd probably be willing to do because it's a much smaller connector. So you could see future Macs and other products using this type of USB 3 connector moving forward. Another advantage of it apparently is that it supports up to 100 watt charging. So that could mean if you had more power coming out of your Mac, you could charge your, you know, across the USB connector, you could charge your devices much more quickly, and it wouldn't take quite as long to recharge your iPad or your iPhone, something like that. So that is a separate kind of connector. So two different things. Apple bringing out a backward compatible USB type connector that's actually reversible, and then this newer USB 3 type C connector that may come out in future models of the Mac. And then another little cold splash of water that came out this week, again from a somewhat skeptical source out of China. They claimed that they had images of a schematic that showed the iPhone 6 will have just 1 gigabyte of RAM, keeping it the same as the current generation iPhone 5S. And a lot of us were thinking it was time for Apple to bump up the RAM once again. We've had 1 gigabyte of RAM in iPhones for several generations now. And a lot of Apple's competitors are doing 2 gigabytes or even 3 gigabytes of RAM. So just kind of catching up. It's always nice to have more RAM, right? You can have more stuff running in the background, things like that. But the same source also claimed that the iPhone would have an NFC chip. And as you know, that's a rumor that I put no credit behind. I think there's no way Apple's doing NFC. They're going to rely on Wi-Fi and low energy Bluetooth technologies like iBeacon and things like that. The NFC thing keeps coming up over and over again, and I just, you know, in my mind, completely discount it. And later, actually, after this report came out, it was pointed out that the 1 gigabyte chip that was in the schematic was actually part of a NAND flash module. So turns out it's not even related to the actual RAM. So I'm thinking that, you know, Apple can do a lot with 1 gigabyte of RAM because of the whole hardware, software, OS integration thing, but it's really time to bump that spec up a bit, and it wouldn't take a lot to do. It's not expensive, so I don't know why Apple wouldn't move forward and just give us a couple, you know, an extra gig of RAM in our iPhones, and I fully expect them to do that. And so at this point, all of the rumors, everything is pointing to Apple entering the sort of final stages of production. As a matter of fact, rumor came out this past week that they've gone into the product validation testing stage. That's the final step before they go into mass production, and that's probably why we've seen so many part leaks kind of hitting the internet and surfacing, and they all seem to support this idea that production should be starting very soon. As far as where production is going to be going on, there was a little switch up in that this week. Digitimes says that Pegatron actually won a contract to produce 25 million of the estimated 50 million 4.7-inch iPhone 6 units. And that would mean that they're getting about 50% of that business. It had been thought that Pegatron would get only around 15% of the iPhone 6 production business, so this would be a lot larger if this turns out to be true, and that means that the remaining 50% of iPhone 6 4.7-inch production would actually be handled by Foxconn. Now, it's not clear who's getting the 5.5-inch production. We seem to not have as many rumors surrounding that, but I would assume that would be Foxconn. Again, also assuming that that product is even a real product, although at this point I'm really feeling Apple is going to have a 5.5-inch model, and I'm in the camp that thinks that both the 4.7 and 5.5-inch will be available at the same time, although I have this gut feeling that the 5.5-inch is going to be in high demand and in short supply at least through the end of this year. So you're going to want to jump on your pre-orders as soon as Apple announces when we can get our hands on those. And as far as when that is going to happen, I think we've talked about the rumored event day, the announcement day being September 9th. And then typically Apple likes to follow on that about 10 days after for when you'll actually be able to sit down and order an iPhone. So that's looking like maybe Friday, September 19th, because they always like to do that on a Friday. That would be the potential, I think pre-sale date. I don't think they'd actually be in stores on that date, although they could surprise us. Earlier would be better, but I think in pre-orders sometime September 19th or so, and then delivery sometime maybe in early October. But we can only wait and see on that. And that's kind of all the latest on the iPhone 6 rumors. If you're an owner of an early 2011 MacBook Pro model, you might want to take note of this, especially if you've noticed any kind of weird graphics issues going on in your system. And I've actually seen a few things on mine that I'm going to mention here in a bit. But according to Apple Insider, they say there's a growing number of owners of early 2011 MacBook Pros who are experiencing GPU-related system failures. They also say that Apple's been aware of these failures, but they don't acknowledge the issue as a widespread problem at this time, so they're not planning on putting out any kind of replacement program. And the bummer is that right about now, a lot of these early 2011 models are reaching the end of life if you bought AppleCare plans. So they're coming out of warranty, which means you're going to be stuck with a bill if you have a problem with your GPU. Now, the trouble seems to be related to failing AMD-built discrete GPUs in some 2011 15-inch and 17-inch MacBook Pro models. Again, these tend to be the early 2011 models. And it's looking like Apple is at least somewhat aware of the issue or actually sort of tracking it, because the Apple Insider piece claims that Apple has escalated Apple authorized service provider requests for further investigation up the chain, and at least a handful of the repair network managers have been informed of the issue. So Apple is taking note of it, although they don't seem to be taking any action on it. So I don't know if they're just gathering information at this point and maybe they're going to do something about it. But all the signs right now from the stuff I've been reading show that they're really not probably going to go forward with anything anytime soon. And it's not clear at this point how widespread the issue is. And that's probably why Apple's holding off. They're trying to figure out, is this a big deal or not? But at least in the Apple Insider piece, they say there was one service provider who claimed to be taking in about 10 laptops per week that are exhibiting this issue. And there's some other signs that it might be pretty widespread. Now, the program Apple uses internally to set up take back, replacement, and exchange initiatives is called their quality program. And it's really only activated in the event of severe, widespread, potentially dangerous hardware failures. So at this point, it feels like Apple thinks that they're not quite there yet. But further evidence that they probably are is that there's a 521-page support thread with more than 7,600 posts and over a million views on Apple's forums. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It's a massive support thread. So I'm not really sure what qualifies as a quote-unquote severe issue, but it definitely seems to be getting there. So I guess our hope is that for a lot of us, Apple will ultimately decide that they need to do an extended repair program, repair replacement program for this. And that's one of the reasons why this story was of particular interest to me, because I actually own an early 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro model, and it just came out of its AppleCare warranty in June. So if anything happens with my GPU, I'm going to be stuck footing the bill unless Apple creates a program. And I, you know, and the model I have now, this current version, was actually a quality program replacement for my 2010 MacBook Pro, which also had GPU failures. So it failed like four or five times, and finally they just replaced it with this 2011 model. And so since I've had this machine, the 2011, I've had little intermittent display issues here and there, stuff that I describe like artifacting, little fritzing on the screen around the edges sometimes, little static kind of tearing of windows as I move them around on occasion. But they've always been these little random and brief moments, and nothing that's ever lasted more than a fraction of a second or something like that. So I've always just kind of dismissed it as an anomaly. But if it degrades further and becomes more and more of an issue, I could be stuck with this problem. So I'm curious how many of you have noticed this if you have a 2011 15-inch or 17-inch MacBook Pro model and think you might be impacted by this. You know, it's really hard when it's sort of intermittent to actually reproduce it at the Genius Bar. So even when you go in, sometimes they look at you like you're crazy. But you probably aren't alone. If you are having this issue, you probably want to jump in, join in on the Apple discussion board thread, you know, call in, at least have your Genius Bar, you know, go into the Genius Bar or call Apple Care. Let them know you're experiencing the problem so that maybe you'll get put into kind of the list to be watched and monitored. And at the very least, they'll know and have a report on file of the issue so that if they do end up doing an extended warranty repair program, you'll be able to kind of take advantage of that. But in the meantime, if you get hit by the issue and you're going to need a repair, Apple's probably going to ask you to foot the bill, which kind of sucks if it really is a widespread problem. And then lastly, in the news for this week, a couple little updates to tell you about. First, Safari got some security patches. If you didn't catch those, Apple released new versions of Safari for OS X Lion, Mountain Lion, and OS X Mavericks. The updates do fix a couple of security issues as well as some WebKit issues. For the newer OSs, there's Safari 7.0.6. And if you're running an older version of the operating system, you get Safari 6.1.6. So if you're not up to date with those latest versions, check your Safari. You can get the updates through the App Store software update feature, or you can get them from Apple's support site at apple.com/support. And then OS X Yosemite Beta 6, the sixth version of the OS X Yosemite Beta, was released out to developers just 2 weeks after the last version. So if you're in the developer program, you can get out there and play with it. It's not clear. I can't tell, and I need to do a little more research to find out if Apple, when they release a beta for the developer program, if they also release a beta for the public beta participants. If you happen to be in that program, let me know if you got a new update. But I think they were having different sort of beta version numbers for developers versus the public beta. And I think the developer ones are coming out a little bit more frequently than the public ones. But the Beta 6 update comes with several visual tweaks and some new wallpapers. Those are the things you're probably going to notice most immediately. All of the wallpapers seem to be Yosemite themed, which I don't think is any big surprise and also very appropriate. There's also all new system preferences icons that have been redesigned and cleaned up to more match the OS X Yosemite look. The Do Not Disturb toggle feature has been brought back into the Notification Center's sidebar. So that's when you open up Notification Center and swipe down, you can quickly toggle on Do Not Disturb. Really handy feature if you just need to turn that on and off for a brief period of time. And then at first launch, you're also going to be presented with a new sharing diagnostic data dialog where Apple will ask you if you want to send diagnostic information on crashes and things like that to Apple, but also if you want to provide that information to third-party app developers. It's actually a separate checkbox, so you can pick one or the other or both, and that's a new little addition to the initial boot up process after upgrading. So those are a couple little tweaks for OS X Yosemite Beta 6, and if you're in the developer program, you can grab that now. But with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. Lynda.com is a site. They help keep you up to date, keep you learning, keep you on top of your software. You can pick up brand new skills with their great online video tutorials. You can also just explore new hobbies. If you're looking to dive into some new topic, it's a great resource and place to go to. They have over 2,400 courses taught by industry experts, and that's actually one thing I really like about Lynda.com. Their instructors are some of the best in their fields. They get really top quality people who know how to give a great presentation, how to give a good talk, and the production value that goes into their tutorials is top notch. They are really well produced and put together, very well structured. You can follow along very easily. They're broken up into nice bite-sized chunks. You can kind of take them all at once if you have a lot of time, or you can take them in little bits and pieces, come back to the course, and they just do a really great job. I've learned so much through Lynda.com. It's really helped me keep up to date with my web development skills. There are always new programming languages and techniques to learn, and I can use their video tutorials to do that. And they stay on top of putting out new courses really quickly. So when a new technology comes out, they usually are right on board. They're right there. If it's not day one, it's within a couple weeks of actually that technology sort of hitting the streets and becoming popular and things like that. And best of all, recently they've updated and added a mobile app for your Apple and your Android devices. So now you can really go on the road and learn anytime, anywhere on your mobile device. So check out that app if you're on a lynda.com plan. And as far as plans go, they have premium plans that will let you download projects, let you actually watch on your mobile devices offline and sort of practice along with the instructors. And you can get in on lynda.com at one low monthly price of $25, gives you unlimited access to the entire library, so you're not restricted. Once you're on the program, you can go in and you can check out all kinds of different topics, really browse around and see what you're interested in. And the organization of just the site and lessons is great too. You can, you know, go by topic, by instructor. So if you find an instructor that you like, you can follow along and get all of their stuff. It's really easy to get through and find what you're looking for. And best of all, MacCast listeners, you get a free trial with access to the entire course library. So all you have to do is go to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And you can try it out for free. And I think you're really going to like it and want to become a subscriber. So take advantage of that great pricing that they have. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. So I got some feedback from many of you about something we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, and that is the target display mode for iMacs, the ability to actually use your iMac's display as an external display for another Mac. That's what Apple calls target display mode. And we talked about it a little bit. It's a feature that Apple added back in macOS 10.6.1, and it allows some iMacs to actually be used as an external display for another Mac. So it's basically the 2009 and 2010 27-inch iMac using mini DisplayPort to mini DisplayPort cables, or if you have an iMac mid-2011 or later, you can connect up with Thunderbolt to Thunderbolt cables. So you take, say, your Thunderbolt MacBook Pro, you connect a lightning cable to it, and then you connect the lightning cable to your iMac mid-2011 or later, and when they're both powered on and awake, you can press the F2 key on the iMac, and it will suddenly become an external display for the MacBook Pro. And when I read through the documentation, Apple has a couple support articles on this, it made it seem like you could do this with any Mac, not just iMacs. Turns out I was wrong on that. A couple of you said you tried this out with your MacBook Pro, your MacBook Air, something like that, and it didn't work for you. I did the same thing after getting your emails. I went and I took my 2015 MacBook Pro. I tried to use either it or my MacBook Air as a target display mode display. Did not work at all. I hooked up the Thunderbolt cable, got nothing out of it. So I went back and read the documentation a little more closely, and it looks like it does have to be an iMac as the target display. Another couple caveats if you're playing around with this: with earlier iMacs, the source iMac can have mini DisplayPort or Thunderbolt ports. So if you have the 2009 or 2011 MacBook Pros and you're using them as a display, you can connect them with mini DisplayPort or Thunderbolt port Macs. If you have a newer iMac, the 2011 or later, your source Mac, the thing that you want to, you know, have shown up on the iMac as a display, that needs to be a Thunderbolt Mac. So I don't know why Apple made that change moving forward. I'm sure there's a good technical reason for it. I really couldn't tell. But I just wanted to clarify that only iMacs can be used as displays in target display mode at this point. I really don't know why that restriction exists. I'm sure it somehow has something to do with the GPUs, maybe the class of GPUs that are in the models. Maybe it's a memory, you know, display memory issue. I have no idea, but you would think, you know, a higher-end MacBook Pro would be perfectly capable of running in target display mode, but they don't do that, and the Tech Info article that I read made it seem like any Mac would work and can function in target display mode, but that obviously doesn't seem to be the case, so apologize for any confusion that last episode may have brought you. Now let's talk a little bit about Time Machine. You know I am a big fan of backup. I use Time Machine on every one of my Macs. I have a Time Machine drive. And Time Machine is really this great technology. It's kind of set it and forget it, right? You buy an external USB hard drive. You plug it into your Mac. It says, hey, do you want to use this for Time Machine? You say yes, and away you go. It starts backing up with Time Machine. And it really is that simple. But over time, things can happen with Time Machine. You start to get little weird messages about space, and it's going to delete files and things like that. And that can be a little bit confusing. And actually, Gary had a question related to the long-term maintenance of your Time Machine drive. So I'm going to play his question here for you. I do want to mention that there is a little bit of noise in this recording. I couldn't really clean it out of there. Some wind noise and stuff like that. So it's near the end. I don't think it's a real big deal. But if it does bother you, you can probably just jump over it. But I thought it was a great question, and I wanted to go ahead and play the whole thing for you.
I'm listening to your podcast on backup drives, and it got me thinking about my recent backup drive issue. I have a 3 terabyte backup that I use to back up my computer as well as my attached drives, locally attached. And it's more than enough. It's like 3 times bigger than all of the, you know, items combined. And I've been backing up for probably, you know, many years. But I've never really done anything special other than, you know, periodically doing the disk utility to make sure the disks are working and so on. But recently, the backup drive has been complaining that it's failed, or not failed, it says, well, the backup drive has not enough space, like that. And then I'm thinking, well, you know, it says that it will delete old backups as needed to create space. So I look in there, and, you know, it's got quite a lot of older backups going back, you know, 3 months. So I called Apple to ask them, you know, what should I be doing here if I'm doing something wrong? And they said that I need to basically buy a new hard drive that's bigger than the old hard drive, or the hard drive I have. And I'm like, why would I need to do that when this hard drive is more than enough space? And they said, well, that's our recommendation. You buy another one, then you could load that one on there. It was very confusing. So, and then I said, I'm not going to do that. That just sounds ridiculous. What is my other option? And they said, well, you can just go in and delete the old backups and go from there. So I'm like, all right, well, that sounds like a good idea. I mean, I don't need going back 3 months of changes. I just need some emergency backup. It would be nice to have the ability to go back 3 months at a time. But in this particular case, I need to move up forward. And she said, just go delete them. So I deleted about a month's worth of items, which took forever to like empty the recycle bin. And finally, it left like these shell pieces of backup drive locations by month from the Time Machine in my trash can. And I'm like, well, how do I get rid of these things? So I, you know, I wanted to call back Apple and say, come on, can you guys give me a complete start to finish so I'm not left with, you know, how to do certain things when you make a recommendation? But I just went to the forums and found a few things and various people offering various commentary on utilities and using the, you know, command windows. And finally someone suggested just holding the Alt key and then emptying the recycle bin, which was the ticket, and it did remove those. And I have moved forward. Time Machine is backing up correctly. But Apple did say, you know, overall that Time Machine needs maintenance, that it doesn't back up forever, and apparently it can only recycle itself for like some period of time, which they were unwilling to kind of pin down. But I'm wondering if you had heard anything like that. Is there a best practice, like you should be wiping out your Time Machine backups after 5 years and starting fresh, or you should really be buying, you know, 10 times the amount of space you really need? I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, if anyone has had that problem. Thanks.
Hey, Gary, I think as I mentioned at the top of the segment here, yeah, I think a lot of people run into little issues with their Time Machine backups. I know I have. My fix is generally a pretty extreme one. So before I get to what I typically do, I want to kind of go over your specific issue, especially for people out there who might be experiencing similar sorts of things. So Gary did follow up with me and emailed me the actual error message that he was getting. It was the backup disk ran out of space unexpectedly. Time Machine will try to make more space available by removing expired backups during the next scheduled backup. So that's the specific message. It is kind of a rare one, but it can come up from time to time. Little background on what's going on here. So typically what happens before Time Machine actually runs a backup, before it starts a backup, it'll go through this preparing phase. And in that phase, what Time Machine does is it kind of searches through your drive and it looks at everything that's been changed. It's trying to determine, you know, what do I need to back up? Kind of figures out what that is and how much storage that's going to take up, and then adds about 20% more, sometimes a little bit more or a lot more, for extra workspace to kind of shuffle things around and things like that. And then it determines, okay, what I need to back up plus this 20% or more extra, is there enough room on the destination drive for me to be able to do what I need to do? If there isn't enough room, what it's supposed to do is start deleting the oldest backups and kind of make space for what it estimates it needs. So it'll go through and it'll start doing that, working its way forward to your most recent backups. But if it figures out that, you know what, I can't even do this without deleting the last remaining backup that you have, then it's supposed to fail. It's typically supposed to fail and give you an error message that says the backup disk is full, meaning that it cannot put any more on that disk without actually, or can't do another Time Machine backup to that disk without actually having to delete the last backup, which would leave you without a backup, which is what you don't want. So it'll say the backup disk is full or the backup is too large. Message something to that effect, and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't copy anything. It doesn't remove anything. Right. In rare cases, though, it might start copying data anyway. And then when it hits the actual space limit, so you see how it's like too full to back up what it needs to do, but it starts to do it anyway. Then you run into the error that Gary got, which was, oh, I tried to back this stuff up, but I ran out of room. And so I'm just going to wait in the next scheduled backup. I'm going to try it to remove some expired content and then go about my business. But the problem is once you hit this error message, you can kind of get stuck in a loop. And there's a couple possible fixes. One thing is there could be an issue with the disk itself. Now, Gary, I know you mentioned you ran Disk Utility and things like that. It's definitely one step you should do is if you run into this problem, run Disk Utility on your Time Machine drive. Just make sure there's no issues with it. And if there are, try and repair those issues using Disk Utility. If you more run into the problem that I think you're having, Gary, where it probably tried to do a backup and then wasn't able to fit everything on there, and so then it kind of left bits of its partial backup behind, which can happen. And what it's supposed to do is in the next scheduled run, it'll go through, it'll see, okay, I don't have enough storage space. I'm going to delete off some of your older backups, and then I'll pick up my backup, the one that I had started that failed before, and finish it up. So what can happen is if you go and look in your Time Machine drive, if you see any .in progress files left on that disk, that's the partial bit that it was going to try and back up, or it started to back up but never finished. Those can get big, and you could end up with multiple of them if you've had multiple failures like this. So those could be the things that are actually causing you not to have enough storage space on your backup drive. So you probably want to try and remove those. So to do that, you need to go into System Preferences, you go into Time Machine, turn off Time Machine, and then go into your Finder, open up the hard drive that has your Time Machine backups, open up the backups.backupdb folder. That's where all your Time Machine backups are going to be on that drive. And then in that folder, look for the folder that has the same name as your Mac, open up that, and then inside that, look for any of these .in progress files. And if you see any of those in the folder, move them to the trash, and then you need to empty the trash. And as you found out, you can't just simply empty the trash. You actually have to hold down the Alt key and empty the trash to kind of force those files to actually get emptied. And that should clear off space. And then hopefully the next time Time Machine backup runs, it should run without issue. But sometimes if you're just having a lot of Time Machine issues, it seems to be failing quite frequently. And this is what I typically do. It's kind of my go-to thing to do because I don't really worry about it so much. I don't necessarily need the history. I more just want the backup. Is to just simply reformat the backup drive and kind of start over, have Time Machine start over from scratch. Some people don't like to do that. I'm really not afraid to do that because I have other backups, right? I have a super duper clone. I have offsite backup. So I can just blow away my Time Machine drive and have it start over with a fresh backup. It'll take a while for that first backup to happen, but then I'm back up and running within, you know, half a day or something like that. I've got my Time Machine back, and it'll just start from that day forward in terms of any changes or things like that. And that works best for me. So you have that option. Now, if you want to get in and do it real surgically, if you want to delete specific items from your Time Machine, so for example, say you know that, you know, last week you deleted that big video project and it was taking up, you know, a gig of space or 5 gigs, whatever it might be, a couple gigs of space, right? And you want to clear that off and get that out of not only Time Machine. So you've deleted it, but right, Time Machine by its nature is going to have a copy of that from a week ago. Well, I don't need that in my backup anymore. You can actually go into Time Machine directly and delete a file from the Time Machine backup. So just turn on Time Machine, activate Time Machine from the menu bar, browse back to where that file is still exists in your Time Machine backup, and then when you find the item, select it, and then you can control click or right click on that item, and you'll notice there is a delete this file from all backups options. So you can select that and actually delete that file completely out of your Time Machine backups and just get rid of it and free up space that way as well. The way you did it is perfectly fine. You can go in, you know, to the individual folders in your Time Machine backup. I like to do it directly through the Time Machine interface itself because then it takes care of all that deleting and emptying trash and all that stuff. You don't have to worry about the alt key and all those sorts of things. But either way, that's going to free up a little bit more space on your Time Machine drive. And then just in terms of general maintenance to kind of finish things up here, all the stuff you've been doing, you know, just making sure that you run disk utility, you check the drive from time to time. Also try and recover some files off of it. So just go into Time Machine mode, make sure that you can pull stuff back off your Time Machine. Do that every couple months or something like that, just to make sure everything's healthy and going well. But other than that, no, it should take care of itself in most cases. If there hasn't been a problem or some sort of weird issue, it should do its normal thing of deleting off the oldest backups when it needs to make more space, and it really should be automatic. But the suggestion to, oh, you need to buy a bigger Time Machine drive, I'm glad you didn't take that advice from the Genius Bar, because I don't think that was a very good one. So thanks for your email, and I hope that, or your voicemail rather, and I hope that helps answer some of your questions about just general Time Machine backup drive maintenance. So I guess storage is going to be one of those things we're going to be talking about on today's episode, and actually running out of storage. This time around, I got an email, and it has to do with iPhoto libraries. If you're like me and like a lot of people, we are taking more and more images. Those images are getting higher and higher quality as you get a new iPhone, right? You're going from 5 megapixel to 8 megapixel to who knows what in the iPhone 6, and our pictures get bigger. And all of those pictures end up in iPhoto or Aperture. In this case, we're going to be focusing on iPhoto, and they can easily get into taking up terabytes of storage pretty quickly, right? Especially if you're adding in video and all those sorts of things. And now that we have SSD drives and solid state drives and flash storage, our internal storage on our Macs is actually getting smaller, not bigger in a lot of cases when we upgrade our machines. That's a little bit of a different sort of turn of events too, right? You buy a new Mac and suddenly you went from 500 gigabyte drive, for example, spindle drive, down to 256 megabytes. And you just don't have enough room. So all of us are looking for more room, more space, and we're tending to pile on bigger and larger files and things like that. So this issue hit Jimmy recently, and he was looking for some solutions. And one he asked me about was, what about just splitting up my iPhoto library and having my most recent photos on the internal drive, but kind of moving everything else off to the external. So I still have access to it, but it's just off on another drive. And I think that is a really great idea and is actually not too hard to do. You can actually do it just with, you know, what's built into iPhoto and your Mac. So the first thing that you'll want to do before doing any of this is make sure that you have a full backup of your current iPhoto library. So have backups, two full backups of your current iPhoto library. And then what you can do is open up iPhoto, and I like to just create a smart album to separate out the current year's photos. So what we're going to do, you know, the concept here, what Jimmy asked me about was, can I take my photos from 2014, have those on my internal drive, you know, the current year's photos, and then everything else, the rest of my giant library archive, off on another bit of space. So to do that, what I would do is I'd make a new smart album in iPhoto. So go under the file menu, choose new smart album, and then set your filter parameters to date, and set the option to is after, and then set the date to 12/31/13. So what that's going to do is create an album, automatically create an album with every photo that has a date after December 31st, 2013. So that would be January 1, 2014 through the current date. And then once you have that set up, you can go to that album, that smart album, select all the photos in there, and then just drag them to a backup drive or to a folder on your desktop, wherever you have some space to actually export them. Now, temporarily, what we're going to be doing is having duplicates of those photos, right? We're going to just throw them all into a folder, into a location, and why we're doing that is going to make sense here in a minute. So do that first. Get all of your current year photos into a place, because we're going to need to re-import those back into a new iPhoto library. So once you've done that, quit iPhoto and then reopen iPhoto, but hold down the Option key. And when you do that, you're going to get a dialog box, and it's going to ask you to choose a library, but there's also going to be an option to create a new one. So you want to press or click on Create New, and then you can choose a new location for your new library. In this case, we're going to want to put it on the internal drive, probably in the pictures folder inside your home folder. That's, you know, the logical place to put it. And give it a unique name. So maybe 2014 iPhoto Library or current iPhoto Library. It doesn't really matter, whatever you want to name it that's going to make sense to you. And then click Save. And then what's going to happen is iPhoto is going to open up with a blank library. So now what you can do is you can go to those photos that you exported earlier off onto an external drive or your desktop or wherever you put them. Just grab those photos and drop them right into your new iPhoto library. And that will import them in and put them into the location that you want. And then you now have a library with just your 2014 photos. So once again, then you can export or quit iPhoto. And then go find your original iPhoto library and then move that off onto an external drive. Just grab it, copy it off onto an external drive. And then once you have that copy, probably what you want to do is verify that you can open and switch between your two libraries. So you're going to have your new 2014 library on your internal drive. You're also going to have your old library probably still on your internal drive. And then you're going to have your old original library off on your external drive. That's going to be your archive, right? And once you move that iPhoto library, don't forget that you're going to want to make sure that you're backing that up automatically with, you know, some other mechanism. So Time Machine or your Super Duper Clone or Carbon Copy Cloner clone, make sure that you are backing that up. And don't forget about that, because if you've moved it off your internal drive, that's an easy thing to actually forget. But now you've got that in two places. So now if you want to open up your old iPhoto library, what you're going to do is, again, hold down the Option key. When you open up iPhoto, it's going to give you that little dialog box, and then you can actually go out and open or go find your old library on that external drive. So find the library, select it, and then just open it, and then when iPhoto opens, you'll be looking at that library. If you want to switch back to the internal drive, quit iPhoto, again, hold down the Option key, and then you can select the library that's on your internal drive. So relatively easy to kind of switch back and forth between your two different libraries. And once you've verified you can open both libraries, then you can go ahead and do some cleanup. You can delete the old iPhoto library from your internal drive to free up that precious space that we've been looking to gain. And a nice thing about this little option trick is it's always going to open the last library that you had selected as the default. So if you just double click on the iPhoto app and open it up, it's going to launch with whatever the last iPhoto library you had selected was. If you want an even easier way, though, to manage all of this, so that's kind of the built-in way, the free way. If you want an even easier way to manage multiple iPhoto libraries, you might want to take a look at iPhoto Library Manager, a great piece of software from Fat Cat Software. It lets you actually separate your iPhoto library and maintains the metadata, all those sorts of things. That's one disadvantage of the method I just described, is any of your metadata, because you've exported out your photos that was attached through iPhoto, is going to get lost when you create that new library. So if you've spent some time with a lot of tagging and things like that, you may want to use a tool like iPhoto Library Manager to actually maintain that. So that'll allow you to separate your iPhoto library into multiple libraries. And it also has additional features like removing duplicates. It can merge libraries as well. So if you've separated some libraries and you want to get them back together, it can handle doing that. It also makes switching between libraries a lot simpler. So that's some software worth looking into. And then I guess just the final thing to mention, and I think we're all guilty of this, I know I am, is you might consider just cleaning up your iPhoto library, right? Think about how many photos are in your iPhoto library that you're never going to look at, you're never going to need. Maybe they're blurry, you've got, you know, your thumb across the lens. Why are you saving all those? I have a ton of screenshots because I'm always taking screenshots with my iPhone, and those all wind up in there. Or little things that you exported out of apps that you had, right? There's so many photo apps that go into your camera roll on your iPhone, and that syncs into your iPhoto library because of PhotoStream or whatever else. So why not get rid of all of those things? Just manually go through and clean up your library and get rid of a lot of the old junk and kerfuffle and all that sort of stuff. So I would recommend one of those things, and certainly separating your iPhoto library is a great way to kind of save space. And as you can see, it's not too tricky to do. So, Jimmy, I hope that helped you out, and thanks for your email. Now let's talk finally a little bit about removing photos in another place, and that is messages. Graciano, and I hope I'm not mutilating your name, Graciano, wanted to know if there is a way to delete all of your photos from the Messages app on your iOS device. And this comes up because that can end up taking up a lot of space on your device. And once again, if you have a 16 gigabyte or a 32 gigabyte device and you're getting a lot of photo MMS messages in the Messages app, it can build up and use up a ton of space because all of that stuff is saved. Graciano has almost 14 gigabytes of messages. And if you don't necessarily know how much you have eating up your storage, you can actually check it in the settings on your iOS device. So go into Settings, General, and then go into Usage, and then scroll and look for the Messages application, and it'll show you how much storage Messages is using up. Now, that's going to be both photos and your text messages, but you can guarantee if you have a large number in there, it's probably mostly photos and MMS messages, especially if you're getting video messages as well. It's going to be videos and photos. Now, unfortunately, I don't believe that in iOS 7 there's any way to globally delete just all of the photos. You can go in and you can swipe on an individual message thread. So if you have saved message thread with a particular person, you can swipe across, or even a group, you can swipe across that in the interface and you'll get the little delete option. So you can delete that entire thread, which is going to delete all of the photos, but you're also going to lose all of the messages in that thread as well. And Graciano, I don't think that's what you wanted to do, right? You just want to delete all of the photos. So you can delete individual messages and photos from a thread by selecting them, but you're going to have to do it thread by thread. There is no way that I'm aware of, and if you know of a way, then be sure to email us and let us know, but there is no way that I know of to actually just globally say for all my messages, every photo that I've ever received, just purge all of those from the Messages app. There's not a way to do that. But if you want to delete them from an individual thread, what you can do is you can open up Messages, select the message thread, so go into it, and then just tap and hold on a photo in that thread. You could also do this with a message, but since we're deleting photos here, tap and hold on a photo, hold for a few seconds, and then there's going to be a little pop-up menu that appears, and there's a more option there. When you tap that, what you'll notice is you'll get little check marks in the left-hand sidebar, and you can check off each message that you want to delete. So just scroll through the message thread, find all the photos, and check all of them. Put a little blue check mark next to each one of them. And then you can tap the trash at the bottom, And then it will ask you, do you want to delete these messages? And then you say, yes, delete messages. So tap on delete message, and it will delete all of the photos from that thread. Again, you can also do this with messages, so you can delete individual messages from a thread, those sorts of things. And in addition, this is the same way, using this little more menu, same way you can select messages and actually forward them instead of trashing them. Just click on the forward icon in the lower right to actually send the selected messages or photos to another person. So if you want to forward on a text message to someone else, you can do that here as well. So that's how you do it in iOS 7. In iOS 8, there's actually going to be this new details view, which actually Apple showed off, I think, at WWDC for a message thread. This is going to allow you to see all of the photos in a thread kind of grouped together. So in iOS 7, to find all of these messages, like I said, you're going to have to scroll through to find all the photos in a thread. In iOS 8, you'll be able to click on details, and they'll all kind of be in this one little section. So again, you can press and hold there, tap on more, and then you can check off each message. So it's going to be a little bit quicker and easier to grab them all within a message thread. But I still don't think there is a global delete all photos option, but that certainly would be a nice option to have. And then the last thing that I'll mention sort of related to this is that if you are going to go through and delete messages or delete photos from the Messages app, before you do that, you might want to pull a backup of just your messages off of your phone. And you can do that with an application like PhoneView from Ecamm or iExplorer from MacroPlant. And with these two applications, you basically hook up your iOS device to your Mac with the USB lightning cable, and then it can see that connected, and it can actually go through, find all of your messages, and allows you to export them off and save them to your Mac. So you can pull them out and do that. And I guess, and I'll have links to both of those applications in the show notes at maccast.com. I like PhoneView from Ecamm. That's the one that I use for doing this. And those apps will do even more sorts of cool tricks, like you can pull off voicemail, audio files, and those sorts of things. So there's some really neat things you can do with those apps. So they're handy little tools to have around. But then again, I guess the last thing I said there, I said that was going to be the last thing, but I do have one more thing. There's another cool little messages trick that I wanted to mention that allows you to reveal timestamps in your messages. So if you're looking at your message thread, you don't know when you received a particular message. If you actually swipe from the right edge of the screen or the interface in messages to the left, then you'll notice it will pull out the timestamps for your individual messages. So you can go back and see, okay, when did I get that? And find out that, hey, I should have responded that I got that message 2 days ago, which is usually how I use this feature. But anyway, that's another cool little trick that you can do in messages that I just wanted to point out. And with that, I think that's going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do have one comment to make. On the last episode, we did a little contest. David Sparks generously gave me 5 codes for his new Mac Sparky Field Guide book on presentations. I was able to give them all away. Unfortunately, for some of you are outside of the US, and it appears that the codes only worked in the US Apple Store. I was not aware of that situation, obviously. David's book is available in other countries. I did check on that, and so I just assumed if it was available in the UK, you could use the code in the UK, but I guess the codes don't cross boundaries. So if you did get one of the codes, feel free to just pass it on to someone you know who can use it. If you don't know anybody that can use it, go ahead and pass it back to me, and I will make sure it gets on to the next person in the list. So we had a little email in contest, and I just awarded them in the order, you know, first in, first out sort of thing, first come, first serve. So if you did get one and you can't use it and you can't give it away to someone who can, please just send it back. And if you are in another country and just weren't able to use the code, you know, David's book is a great value. If you're looking to give better presentations, and not just in Keynote, with in whatever application you use, it's a great book because he goes into Keynote stuff, but he also goes into great hints and tips and tricks for just how to give great presentations and how to put together great presentations. The Max Sparky Field Guides are all really great. You should check them out. And again, thanks to David for kind of passing on those codes to us. But that's it for now. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. All awesome applications. I own them all, and I think you should too. You can check them all out and get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you know what? Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And that's particularly important right now because the iPhone 6 is coming out. Maybe you want to get cash for your old device to use to buy your iPhone 6. Gazelle has extended their lock-in time frame. They're now doing it for 50 days. So you can go over to Gazelle right now, get an offer on your current iPhone, lock it in, and you don't have to send it in, I think, until sometime in October at this point. So that should give you plenty of time to get your new iPhone and then send your old one into Gazelle, and you'll have the cash to kind of cover the cost of that new purchase. So check that out, gazelle.com. And then I'd also like to thank lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. I'd also like to thank a couple of supporters. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. That's at cachefly.com. And advertising on the show is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. I'd like to say a big thank you to you for listening, for staying subscribed. I appreciate your support. I also very much appreciate your audio comments and your emails. If you have a question for me, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or something you're just having trouble with and need some help, you can send your email, your audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on our listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can also check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And we're on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast in Google Plus communities, and you'll find a bunch of folks hanging out there and just talking and chatting about all things Mac and Apple. But with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.